What about the origins of words that are also names, like Nick? Some of Nick's obsolete meanings, reckoning or account, slang for the vagina. But I dated a Nick in college, briefly, between boyfriends. I'd prefer that memories of Nick, him telling me, "I could tell you weren't very cultured when I met you," and "How have you not heard of Broken Social Scene?" and "I don't understand why you won't sleep with me if you like me, not influence this project." Though I like the sound of Nick. So I want a monosyllabic word that works as a name and contains a K. Mark, maybe? Its main definition, a boundary. And that's what this is about, boundaries. Perfect. Mark, then. Why should I protect Mark? I enter his work address in Google Street View. Instead of his pale yellow office building on an industrial one-way street, I aim my view at the clouds and telephone wires. The wires don't line up precisely. There are gaps of just sky. Gaps between communication. I should stop searching for metaphors. Mark and I stopped speaking to one another in college. He was in Ohio studying engineering. I was in Illinois majoring in journalism. He dropped out shortly after we last spoke, which is not to say I'm the reason, or that what happened between us is the reason, but I hope it's the reason, or rather, what he did to me during winter break of our sophomore year is, I hope, the reason. I can't forget. I was passed out. Mark now manages a camera shop. I recently found an online forum where he answers questions about cameras. Someone asked if a blur in a photo can be good, and Mark replied, "If the intent is to give an abstract rendering for some artistic reason, then it's acceptable. When no such intent exists, it's merely bad technique that has caused something that should be sharp to blur." If he could photograph that night, would he blur it? Where would he blur it? My memory is blurry, there are gaps. But I know what he did, and he does too. The next day, or maybe a few days later, he apologized. "I should not have done that to you. I am so sorry. It was not okay. Can you ever forgive me?" I said I could. I said I would. I told him to read J.D. Salinger's Franny and Zoe, my favorite novel back then. I cringe at the memory. He read it and told me it reminded him of us. But no one in the book carries his drunk friend into a basement, takes off her clothes while she's passed out, fingers her, masturbates over her while she cries, and tells her, "It's just a dream." "I'm so glad you liked the book," is what I said. A year later, Mark dropped out of college. He moved back home, tried therapy, became a mechanic. At least this is what his dad told my mom. By then, our friendship had ended, though I doubt his parents and siblings knew why. Friends grow apart, is probably what they thought. As with many things after my dad died, I never told my mom. Mark, according to LinkedIn, returned to college, earned a bachelor's in interdisciplinary studies, and, several years later, a master's in civil engineering. When we were friends, I told him, "Someday you'll become a famous engineer. You'll discover a formula so complicated that high school students will write it on their wrists before exams." Every time I think about him, I feel pissed off and sad. I understand now why nostalgia, for hundreds of years, was considered a chronic mental illness. I want to hate him, but I can't.
I've been listening to Jeannie Vanoska read from Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. Hi again. This is me, David Naiman, who you are currently listening to talk to Jeannie Vanoska. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Between the Covers is one of the main places you go to hear in-depth, long-form, literary conversations in Portland. I wanted to remind you that you can donate today to keep community-supported radio at KBOO Portland alive and strong. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online at kboo.fm/give. and there is really no better time than now to give. If you support KBOO now, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000 until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroix Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, think about all the conversations you've heard. Today's conversation with Jeannie Venasco, the conversations recently with Joe Sacco and Nikki Finney and N.K. Jemison and Morgan Parker. Think about all the conversations about literature that have engaged with KBOO's core mission and the things that you yourself are concerned about day to day. Social justice, the rise of fascism, climate justice and global climate apocalypse, women's rights, trans rights, indigenous rights, and Black Lives Matter, and all the interesting angles into the ways writers and artists have been engaging with these very concerns. Head over to kboo.fm/give to show us that this programming is something you value and you want to endure. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. And now back to today's episode of Between the Covers with writer Jeannie Venasco. And you mentioned the big fear of failure on the political level, which is giving a platform to someone who raped you, giving him any space or somewhat on his terms and someone not on his terms. But there's also all these small things like you quickly forgiving him, that, you know, cringeworthy scene with Franny and Zoe, you not hating him, which none of them fall into the sort of broadest cultural narrative of how to speak about this politically, let's say, right? Like, I'm not talking as a writer or an artist or as an individual human being, but these anxieties around, am I being a good feminist, or how will feminists other than me respond? How big of an anxiety was it? How did you engage with it as you wrote? I'm guessing you must have been excited, maybe relieved that, you know, Melissa Phoebos, Alyssa Wishuda, Sophia Shalmiev, Carmen Maria Machado, all of these outspoken writers who engage with similar questions are all champions of the book, but you couldn't have known that.
I was terrified when I would ask, you know, there were times like I chose not to apply for certain things because they require letters of recommendation. So I'm not good at asking for things like that. So when I reached out to some writers to ask if they'd be willing to blurb the book, I think I prefaced it with, you know, telling them what it was about, no hard feelings if they felt uncomfortable doing so, you know, and I was really terrified that everyone would come back and say, like, how could you do this? This is a huge betrayal to everything that feminists, or, you know, not everything, but this is a huge betrayal to the feminist movement. And it was a relief that, for the most part, people were really supportive, and writers whose work, you know, I love and admire and teach. That was exciting for me. But I assumed I would get some pushback, and, you know, and it's strange, like after the pandemic started, I've received some hate mail, which is like a unique type of person. Like, I was like, who? Like, we're in a global pandemic. There's so much going on. Like, what even is the thought process there? Like, this is a really stressful time for everyone. Like, I know I'll reach out to this rape survivor about her book and tell her how terrible I think she is and that she just did this for money. But for the most part, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. But, you know, as a writer, sometimes the things that get stuck in your head are the negative ones.
Right.
But while I was working on the book, certainly, I mean, this question of am I being a good feminist, which I know is like a really reductive question, but it's interesting that I talk with Mark about that question, and And I mean, I talked with a lot of my female friends about it. But yeah, while I was working on it, my big fear was that, I don't know, that I would be betraying a feminist cause, or I would be letting down, you know, my students in some way, or it scared me. So it was a huge relief when praise came in from writers whose work I admire.
Yeah. Well, I want to return to the blurb that I read it in the introduction by Adrian Westerfeld that says, your book lives masterfully in the messy liminal space, because it feels like it is the messiness, or perhaps not messiness, but the instability and volatility that it holds us in, where words like rape and consent and victim and perpetrator suddenly become more unstable. It is that aspect of the book that for me gave it its power. And the reading experience because of this is both super compelling and also at the same time, it's holding us in an uneasiness. And I wanted to bring up the uneasiness of the reading experience, particularly around Mark. For instance, you're asking consent from your rapist to participate in the project. So that's one way you take this word consent and make it strange to us and uncomfortable. And it feels like you're very self-aware of the surreality of doing that. I'm also not sure you could have planned for or dreamed up a more effective character profile of a rapist that would hold us more in the messy liminal space, that would create more uneasiness than the way Mark ended up being. Like, it would have been easier, I think, if he'd been monstrous when you'd reached out, or super defensive or passive aggressive or aggressive, or if he tried to gaslight you, or if he were in full-on denial, or he just said no. Any of those would have sort of confirmed my comfort with the binary victim-perpetrator narrative. But his reactions are of an entirely different sort. And later in the conversation, I want to go into what true accountability would look like and what your thoughts are on restorative justice are and punishment. But I want to just put those questions aside for now and talk about this other aspect of Mark. He not only agrees to participate, he agrees to be recorded. He signs a waiver without needing to read your book. He tells you that you shouldn't go easy on him because he doesn't deserve it. He's willing to use the word rape to describe what happened when you're still feeling uncertain about whether to use the word. And when you meet up with him again after 14 years, it is also clear that your life seems to have a trajectory, whereas his seems to have sort of stalled out. He's stuck, rather self-isolated, without a great sense of a future. And this puts the reader, at least it puts this reader, in a weird place of sometimes, against my own desire, feeling sympathy for Mark, of experiencing, maybe as a first response in some of these interactions, the way he cares for you or cares about what happened that he did. So I wanted you to talk about Mark as character in this book, and also whether his responses in this regard presented writer challenges for you on how to write it. Like, whether something about the encounter and him having all of these qualities, how much of that was, you knew him, but how much of that was anticipated, and how much of it was, okay, how am I going to adjust my project around what he says to accommodate for this response from Mark, which in certain regards is he's game to participate and own up, at least in a recording with you and then in this book, that he did what he did, and name it with the legal vocabulary that would describe it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll answer your question, but it got me thinking about how some emails I've received from readers, a couple of people asking me why I didn't prioritize writing about the friend who raped me in my 20s. And ultimately, the project comes down to language. And that's why it was actually very strange to say validating when Mark was willing to use the word rape. But because for the situation, like the encounter I had with Mark, I felt a lot of insecurity around using that word, because he used his fingers. And it was a big realization for me to think about how I had been prioritizing his body and thinking about which part he used and not my body, which part he violated. And it seems so obvious to me now when like I state it, but for a long time I couldn't conceptualize it in those terms. And Mark telling me when I confronted him with the definition and him saying, well, if that's, you know, that's the word, then, you know, that's what it is. I wasn't, to answer your question, I wasn't so surprised by the way he responded. I mean, it was hard. We hadn't talked for 14 years, so I still had this concept of him as not so much like what he did that night. I didn't necessarily think of him as like a rapist. I ultimately thought of him as this person who'd been one of my best friends. And he was someone who was really there for me after my dad died. We had this incredibly close relationship where, you know, we could sit in silence with one another and it not be uncomfortable. I mean, I really trusted him. And so that's why I think, I mean, any rape is a betrayal, but this really felt like, it seemed so out of character for him. Like the way he reacted in the book, that all seemed within his character or the Mark I knew. It was what he did that night that to me was so incredibly out of character. And that was hard for me to reconcile. And I think for him, he thought it was out of character for him. He told me he never thought that was something he was capable of. And it's partly why I think I felt it important to pursue this book in the way that I did, because often when we see portrayals of rapists, particularly in film and TV, they do tend to be really monstrous. And I think the longer we go on seeing rapists as monsters, the harder it will be to hold like the quote seemingly nice guys accountable. And it seems like a large, I don't want to say, it's not that, I'm not making the argument that most men are rapists, but most rapists tend to be men. And it makes it hard to see the seemingly nice guys as capable of doing something like this or of holding them accountable. So for me, the way in which Mark reacted and his openness, his willingness to participate, if anything, I did feel guilty as the book progressed, because there was a certain point where I think he thought we were becoming friends again. And there was a point at which I almost hoped it could happen, but it just felt impossible. But I think he really thought we might carry on this relationship, this friendship. And I did feel like I was betraying him. And I had these conversations with my partner, Chris, about it. And he's like, no, you were open with him. You were upfront that this is what you were doing. But it was hard for me to stop thinking of Mark as someone who'd been one of my best friends, you know, for 5 years. He seemed to have acted entirely within character when I was interviewing him.
Yeah. Well, there's a million things that I want to talk about regarding the transcripts of your recorded conversations with Mark, because the transcripts are doing a ton of work in this book. But one of the things it does is juxtapose two very different aesthetics and tonal and syntactic experiences as a reader, as we encounter one transcript and then after your prose, and then after that, another transcript. And a juxtaposition not only of written words and then spoken words, but also the juxtaposition of sections where you have total control of the words, chosen by you with deliberation, and sections where you only have partial control over the words because they're happening in real time and they're spoken in conversation with a person and you don't know what they're going to say. So I'd be interested to hear a little bit, especially since you have a background in poetry, any thoughts or pleasures or displeasures you have about placing the crafted and the uncrafted, or the written and the oral, up against each other, but then also about having and relinquishing control from your own words to words that are in dialogue, and how that might echo against questions of power and consent.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting for me transcribing the audio of my conversations with Mark, where, I mean, it was mortifying hearing myself be very accommodating right from the beginning, like, oh, no, it's okay. Like, it's in the past. I'm okay now. I have enough distance. And I immediately trying to put him at ease. And I really thought going into my conversations with him, I would be tougher. And So I mean, there's a huge part of me that's embarrassed for how I responded to him. But then I thought, well, it's important to include that because that is how I responded. And of course, there's this initial impulse like, oh, that like of me being overly accommodating. Maybe I could just like delete one more sentence where I'm saying like, I hope you understand. I hope this is helpful to you. Like all of like, maybe I could cut it back a little bit. But I wanted to include that repetitiveness of my trying to make him feel at ease, because I think that is that can it does feel like a particularly gendered behavior. I know men who do this as well. But I was just so mortified, and it was interesting to me then to look at these passages and then reflect on them, on the transcripts. And I liked it from a craft perspective of giving the book some texture, and thinking about like my background in poetry. I mean, I still read poetry regularly. I love it. And when I think of something as being poetic, I don't necessarily think of it being as needing to be poetic on the sentence level or the level of the line, but so much of it has to do with the way a poem or a work moves. And I think a lyric structure often operates by these associative leaps, or putting very, you know, like building a metaphor, putting two very unlike things alongside one another, and then the energy that emerges from that. So figuring out the structure at first, usually a project doesn't feel entirely alive to me until I can see the shape. But as soon as Mark said yes, that he would agree to these conversations, I thought, okay, transcripts, like that is probably going to be how I structure the book. And that was really helpful to me. But it was like having those breaks where I can like reflect on what I actually said to him, and then talk with my friends about how he reacted, and then share the transcripts with them. It was interesting to be able to have a little bit of hindsight on something that happened relatively recently. Yeah.
Before we leave the topic of transcripts, I want to talk about my favorite effect that they were having. And it's something you've already touched on a tiny bit. And it's the way that I feel like the transcripts become a node for making meaning in the book, because we get your own analysis of yourself and of your previous encounters with Mark prior to a given transcript, and then the meaning making that happens after an encounter. But it's particularly engaging and interesting because you involve a whole bunch of other people in the act of making meaning. So for one, your editor is a character in the book. So questions of how to make the book are part of the book, but also your editor is chiming in around a given encounter or anticipated encounter or the aftermath of an encounter. But also other people involved are your husband, friends, a friend who you met in the psych ward, other writers. And these people, they point out things that you didn't notice about how you acted or Mark acted, or differences in how they interpret something that was said versus you. And sometimes that's on the level of examination of language, where they will point out something that to you sounded fine or even great. And the more you pressed into the language that Mark used, aided by blank, your editor, husband, friend, writer, colleague, becomes part of the book and part of your own analysis. And I guess I was just hoping you could talk about this way that you've invited the world really into the book as the book is being written. It's really great how you do this.
Thank you. Well, it's helpful. I think it's something that can happen when you're deep in a project, at least it does for me, where suddenly you look around and everything has potential. And it's a great way where, you know, I love writing. It's work, but it also, it gives me so much pleasure. And so sometimes it can be hard for me to leave my desk or my bed where I'm writing. And, my partner, Chris, will suggest maybe we should go see people. And I was able to talk myself into going out and having fun, thinking, maybe there will be something there that I can use. So I did remain open to just like daily encounters. Like, you know, when my hairdresser asked me what I was writing about, and suddenly I thought, oh, is it rude to tell her? Is that going to make her uncomfortable? But I think it's something I probably got from Sheila Hetty, where it's just when I read her fiction or autofiction, when I read her books, there is an openness to life as it unfolds. And I love that. I absolutely love that. And so I think that was a great influence on me. But certainly, yeah, I mean, if we think about the definition of plot being the meaning of events, then for me in memoir, reflection is the plot. The thinking is the plot, because that's how you're making sense of the events. And I liked the idea of this being a collective reflection where I could talk with my friends, talk with Chris, talk with my editor, Maisie, and my therapist, and think through what the truth of this situation was. Because when I would read the transcripts, I mean, initially I thought, oh, how nice of Mark, he agreed to talk to me. And meanwhile, my friends were a lot tougher reading the transcripts. Like when Mark, he took photographs of an abandoned factory and sent them to me because he thought they would be useful to my writing, because I don't know, they showed his interior state. And I thought, oh, thank you for the metaphors, that's so nice. And then my friends, Jung and Molly, see that in the transcripts and they're like, what? He sent you photographs to share his feelings? And they were so annoyed. But I think it's hard because, you know, as my friend Jung, who's a writer, you know, and Molly's a writer, but Jung had told me, you know, like, I care for you so much, so it's hard for me not to be angry at him. And for me, it was hard to hold on to anger at times because I was thinking back to the friend that he had been, and he seemed so remorseful, and I don't know, like I wanted, there's a way in which I was very nostalgic for that friendship. So I was willing to look past a lot. But also as a writer, I'm, you know, thinking about what's useful, what's material, what can be transformed. So there is a way in which all of that is useful and I appreciate it. And I think if I didn't have the book, if I hadn't been writing the book, if I had just been reached out to Mark to talk about what had happened, there could be a way in which that would be really annoying to me, him sending me photographs. But as a writer, I think, oh, that's interesting. Now I have some, because now I have some visual imagery, because like having these conversations, it's hard to, you know, include a lot of scene. And so I was grateful, but I think I was grateful as a writer, not as someone who's living this experience. So it was a way, there was a way in which the book got in the way of my processing the experience and how I thought and felt about it.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, thank you for being on Between the Covers today, Jeannie.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking today to Jeannie Fenosco, the author of Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7